from the University of Chicago, and Shuyang Song from Harvard will be handling the Q&A. So Michael will be giving one of two lectures on partons. So Michael, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. My name is Michael Levin, and I'm gonna be talking about, as Tim said, I'll be talking about something called the parton construction. So let me start by just telling you, what is the parton construction? Basically, the way I think about it, at least, it's basically a method for constructing interesting many-body states low-energy theories. It doesn't so much, maybe I should write that down. It's really a method for constructing possible states. Okay, so method for constructing sort of interesting body states. And it gives you both, the construction gives you both like a state, like a wave function, but also gives you a low energy theory that describes kind of the excitations above that ground state. So it gives you both many body states and low energy theories. What do I mean by interesting? So I'm not going to try to give a precise definition here, but the kinds of states it gives you are things like, including things like things that have topological order, things that have emergent gauge theories. It basically allows you to construct states beyond kind of the boring symmetry breaking states that you get from, say, a traditional mean field theory. And in some sense, the parton construction can be thought of as some kind of generalized kind of mean field theory. I don't know how much I'm going to emphasize that in these lectures, but it's some kind of more general construction that lets you go beyond traditional mean field states and get more interesting states, topologically ordered states, gauge theories, and low energy theories, and get their corresponding low energy theories. So the parton construction is actually pretty old. It goes back to at least the 1980s, maybe before then. As far as I know, the references I'm familiar with start in the 80s. It has a number of applications because it's a pretty general construction. But the two major applications and the two that I'm going to open these lectures are basically to spin liquids. So it lets you construct interesting spin liquid states. These are states of many spins interacting with each other. The other major application is to quantum Hall states. So it lets you construct pretty interesting quantum Hall states. But these aren't the only applications. It's certainly been used and maybe even started. One of the first uses was actually to understand questions about the Hubbard model and high C and so on. So there are other systems which you can use where you can apply this method, but the two that I'm going to talk about here will be spin liquids and quantum Hall states. Okay, so let me just, the thing about the parton construction, I just want to give a few references. The thing about the parton construction is, although it's pretty old, there aren't really too many pedagogical references that, explaining it. It's a bit of a struggle, but I've tried to find a few references. These are the references that I think might be a good place to start if you're just starting to learn about the parton approach. So one reference is the textbook by Xiaogan Wen, so Quantum Field Theory of Many Body Systems. So there's a chapter on sort of parton constructions. Another reference, which I think is a nice place to start, is there's a review article by Balance, Leon Balance, and Lucille Savory, which is on the archive. I don't know. I'm just going to give you the archive number. I'm sure it's published also. These two references are good places to learn about the application to spin liquids. For quantum Hall, I think the situation is even bleaker in terms of sort of pedagogical references. So the two papers maybe I would start with, and which I, these lectures are loosely, I don't know if I would say based on, but the two papers that are probably closest to these lectures, there's an old paper by Block and Wen. It's PRB 42. It's from 1990. And then there's another paper around the same time, a single author paper by Wen. It's a PRL. So those are two places you could start if you want to know a little bit about the quantum Hall application. Oops, ran out of space there. Okay, so those are references. So now I just wanted to let you know about those in case, because I'm not going to be giving references as I go. So everything I'm going to talk about at some level can be found in one of those places. If you have any questions about references, you can always ask me, but those are the places I would start if you want more details. Okay, so let me now start with the first application, the application to spin liquids. And that's what I'm going to be talking about, I think, pretty much this whole lecture. I'm not going to talk about quantum Hall states at all. So let's talk about the parton construction of spin liquids. Okay, so the basic setting here, you can think about spin liquids in many different dimensions, but I'm going to focus on the two-dimensional case just for concreteness. So the setting for me is going to be, I'm just going to think about a spin 1/2 model on the square lattice. Okay, and so we have some lattice of spins. Each one of these dots is supposed to have two states. Okay, and now the question that we want to answer is, how can we construct interesting spin states? And among the interesting spin states are things called spin liquids. Those are states which break any symmetries. They don't break any lattice symmetries like translation, and they also don't break spin rotation symmetry. So it turns out that for a spin 1/2 model on the square lattice, there's a theorem, the Liebscholz-Mathis theorem, that tells you that a spin liquid state kind of has to be interesting. It has to be something beyond a kind of boring kind of product state. It has to have some entanglement or something going on. So a spin liquid is an example of an interesting state, but more generally, how can we construct sort of interesting states that have some entanglement, that have things like topological order or emergent gauge fields? And there, the parton construction gives you a way to do this. And there are two major parton approaches to construct these states. Basically, you can either use something called slave fermions, which is based on kind of fermionic partons. But you'll see what that means in a second. Or you can use something called slave bosons, which involve bosonic partons. And slave bosons also are sometimes called, or at least you can call them Schwinger bosons. Okay, so there's two ways and they're very closely related, these two approaches. As I said, one involves fermions, one involves bosons. In this lecture, I'm going to focus on the fermion approach. So I'm going to talk about the slave fermion construction. I don't think I'll say much about bosons, but the basic idea is very similar. So I want to talk about the slave fermion construction. So what's the idea in the slave fermion construction? Basically, the starting point is to, it's a little strange. We want to construct a spin state, a pure spin state, which is in this Hilbert space of just spin 1/2. But to do that, we're actually going to consider an enlarged Hilbert space. So instead of thinking about this simple spin 1/2 space we're going to that I just told you about, we're going to consider an enlarged Hilbert space, which consists of this enlarged Hilbert space is going to describe spin 1/2 fermions, itinerant spin 1/2 fermions hopping on the square lattice. So to be clear what I mean by that, so, you know, we have our lattice again. And now instead of just having those two states per site, we're actually going to have four states per site. So for each site, there are actually four states because, well, you can have the empty state, which I'll just write as zero. It means no fermions there. Or we have a spin up fermion there, which I'll write as F up dagger zero. Or you could have a spin down fermion. Or you could have both. Okay. So this enlarged Hilbert space has dimension 4 to the n, where n is the number of sites, whereas our original Hilbert space had dimension 2 to the n. Okay. Now, although this is a larger Hilbert space, it's not totally unrelated to our space. In particular, we can think of the spin Hilbert space as sort of sitting inside it. So note that I'll call it H spin kind of sits inside of H fermion. And to the natural way to kind of embed the spin Hilbert space inside is to just think of the spin up state. We just identify the spin up state with this the F dagger. So identify the spin up state with having a single spin up fermion on that site, and identify the spin down state with having a single spin down fermion. In other words, if we restrict ourselves to occupancy with one fermion, then it looks just like the spin Hilbert space. We can have a spin up fermion there or spin down fermion there. We can identify that with our original states in our original spin system. Okay, so the spin Hilbert space sits inside the fermion Hilbert space. The fact that it sits inside means that every spin operator that you write down can be written, can kind of be, there has some, can be written in terms of the fermions. So in particular, if you want to write this kind of in terms of operators, if you think about a generic spin operator S on a given site, I'm not writing the site index here, but it's acting on a given site. You know, you can have SX, SY, SZ. Those three operators can be written in terms of the fermions as a fermion bilinear. In particular, we can write S is equal to, I'll write it this way, 1/2 F alpha dagger. So just to be clear what this equation means, so alpha and beta are spinner indices. They can be either up or down. Sigma is the usual Pauli matrix. And so this equation just allows, you know, it's the obvious equation for how you can write the spin operator in terms of these fermions. So SZ would be equal to F alpha dagger sigma Z. SZ would be like F dagger sigma ZF, and SX would be like F dagger sigma XF, and so on. So there are actually three equations I've written here for the three components. So far we just enlarged the Hilbert space and noticed that we can think of our spin system as kind of sitting inside it. So the next step in the parton construction is to kind of, is to now think about these fermions, these so-called slave fermions, and just imagine writing down, we're gonna just imagine writing down some quadratic fermion Hamiltonian. Okay, so this will just, we could just write down a generic quadratic fermion Hamiltonian. So consider a quadratic. The fact that it's quadratic, makes our life easy. It's not interacting. It's something we can easily solve. So we write down a quadratic fermion Hamiltonian, which looks something like this. So it's a sum of it could have some hopping term like this. So Tij, alpha, beta are the hopping terms. And it could have, in general, could also have some pairing term. So I'll write it like this. Okay, and so this is some pretty generic quadratic fermion Hamiltonian with both hopping and pairing. I and J are, could be nearest neighbor sites, but we could also have further range hopping or pairing. There's no restriction, although we probably do want it to be local. And then, of course, in general, we can also have some on-site chemical potential. Oh, I should say here, I should have said this earlier, I'm using a convention, sort of the usual convention where, summation convention, where if you see two alpha indices that together in the same equation, there's a, it means that you should sum over alpha. So I used that in a previous equation too when I wrote this over here. That's not what I meant to do. Over here I have this summation convention and here as well. So now the idea is we write down this quadratic fermion Hamiltonian and it's something simple. We can find its ground state. So let's let psi naught be the ground state. So let psi naught be the ground state. And the idea is psi naught, we're going to use psi naught, which is something we can easily calculate because it's a quadratic fermion Hamiltonian. We're going to use psi naught to construct a much more interesting state in our spin Hilbert space. Okay, so this is a state that lives in our fermion Hilbert space, but we're going to use it to construct a state in our spin Hilbert space. So the first thing to recognize is that in general, psi naught, of course, does not live in the spin Hilbert space, right? So psi naught does not live in this H spin because it doesn't in general obey this single occupancy constraint. So the single occupancy constraint, if I write it out, something like again using a summation notation, is the constraint that F dagger F I here labels lattice sites. I guess I should have said that. Sorry. I is labeling lattice sites and alpha and beta are labeling spin directions. So this constraint says the number of fermions on site I should be 1, right? That's the constraint that's obeyed within our subspace that we identify with our spin Hilbert space. In general, psi naught doesn't obey that. It has some sites which are doubly occupied, some sites which are empty. So we can't really think of it as a spin state. However, we can still use it to construct a spin state if we make one more assumption. So we're going to be interested in the case where, although psi naught may not obey this constraint exactly, it obeys it on average. So in the case where psi naught obeys the constraint, the single occupancy constraint on average. So in other words, the expectation value, although the number is not 1, we want the expected number of fermions on a given site to be 1. Okay. And of course, that's possible. We can certainly find, not only is it possible, pretty much we can almost always arrange for this as the case by adjusting that our site-dependent chemical potential here. Okay, so we're going to be interested in the case where that site-dependent chemical potential has been adjusted to a value such that the average number of fermions on each site is 1. So if that's the case, then, okay, it's still true that psi naught is not in our spin Hilbert space, but it's somehow close to being in the spin Hilbert space. And on average, it sort of is in the spin Hilbert space. And so then the idea of the parton, or what's going to happen with the parton construction is we're going to be able to use this psi naught to construct an honest-to-goodness spin state, a state that lives in our spin Hilbert space. Okay, but before we do that, let me just say, just some terminology. Any Hamiltonian, any quadratic Hamiltonian, such that its ground state obeys this constraint on average, is called a mean field. We'll call it a mean field ansatz. So any H naught with this property, the above property, is called an ansatz or a mean field ansatz. Okay. And we're going to be interested in H naughts with this property. Quadratic Hamiltonians whose ground states have, on average, one fermion per site. Okay. So. Okay. So now, what are we going to do? So the now I can state the basic claim or the main result. I summarize the main result of the slave fermion construction. What the slave fermion construction does is it takes H naught as input. So H naught, this mean field ansatz, is kind of an input into the construction, and from it, it produces a spin state and a low energy theory. So let me sort of say that here. So the slave fermion construction. Takes this ansatz H naught as an input and produces two things. One, a spin state, which I'll call psi spin. And the other thing it produces is a low energy theory. And that low energy theory is going to be basically a Hamiltonian and a Hilbert space. So I'm just going to emphasize the Hamiltonian here. So I'm going to call that Hamiltonian or that low energy theory H effective. It's going to be some low energy theory or low energy Hamiltonian. And so these are the two, this is what it does. So we take in this H naught and it produces a spin state and a low energy theory. Now the claim, of course, is that this spin state and this low energy theory are not just random states. They have some nice properties. So what's the main claim? And I actually will call it kind of hope, because I'm not sure how, as I'll say maybe a little bit more about this later, it's not clear, it's not so easy to derive this construction, put it on a really rigorous foundation. So we hope, and we can give some arguments for why this hope is reasonable or not totally crazy. We hope that these states have the following properties. So the first one is that that psi spin is a physical spin state. So it's the ground state of some local Hamiltonian. We have no idea what that Hamiltonian is. That's one of the weaknesses of the parton construction, but the hope is that there's some Hamiltonian which has this as its ground state. Okay, so that's one thing. So that it's producing kind of a physical state, spin state. And the other hope, of course, is that this low energy theory is correctly describing the low energy excitations of this, whatever this Hamiltonian, this mystery Hamiltonian. So H effective correctly describes the low energy excitations, or at least their universal properties, correctly describes low energy excitations of such a spin Hamiltonian. Okay, so the hope is that the state we're producing is physical, and the low energy theory is the correct description of the low energy excitations above that state. Okay, so. So these are the claims, and what I want to do, so the basic philosophy, what I want to do here is I just want to tell you how the construction works. So how do you construct this spin state? How do you get this effective Hamiltonian? And then after I do that, and this may happen more next time, tomorrow, I'll try to say a little bit about the derivation, you know, why we expect it to work, or in under what circumstances we expect this construction to work. So for the moment, I'm not really going to justify the construction. I'm just going to tell you the recipe, how the slave fermion construction produces a spin state and how it produces a Hamiltonian. So let me start by I'm going to start with this spin state. That's the easiest thing. So I'm going to describe how to construct psi spin. Okay, so. Okay, so the idea for constructing psi spin is kind of straightforward. The idea is we have this psi naught state, which sort of on average is in a spin-Hilbert space, but not exactly. So what we're going to do is just force it to be in the spin-Hilbert space. We project it onto the spin-Hilbert space, and that's all. That's it. So we're going to construct psi spin by projecting psi naught into H spin. So psi spin, just write it as E times psi naught. This is supposed to denote the permission projection operator that projects the projection into H spin. Okay, so it projects onto single occupancy states. So you throw out all the components of psi naught that are not single. If you expand out psi naught and throw out all the pieces that are doubly occupied or unoccupied. So if you want to write out this this projection more explicitly, we can also write it out in terms of wave functions. So let me just do that. So in terms of wave functions, your spin wave function, you can think of it as a function of, suppose we have m spins. So m is the number of spins here. So here alpha I can be up or down, and m is the number of spins. Okay, so any spin state can be written as a wave function on up and down, on m ups and downs, ordered in some arbitrary way. So if we want to write it in terms of wave functions, the spin wave function can be obtained by taking our state psi naught and then hitting it with some fermion destruction operators. So I'll write as F1 alpha 1, F2 alpha 2, Fm alpha m. And then taking inner product with this is zero is supposed to be the vacuum state, the empty state. Okay, so this just does exactly what I've written up above here in this projection operator. By hitting it with these fermion operators and then taking inner product of the vacuum, I throw out all the components of psi naught except for those that have exactly one fermion per site. Okay, so this defines a valid spin wave function, and that's how we get our spin state. And notice that an interesting fact here, as we'll see, is that although psi naught is a boring quadratic fermion state, it's something sort of, we wouldn't call it interesting, I think. When we do this projection, it can create an interesting state with entanglement and with all kinds of non-trivial properties. So it's really there's some magic in this projection. Okay, so, and that's in some sense one of the, maybe the essence of the slave particle or the parton constructions. All of these constructions involve a projection where you take a state in a bigger Hilbert space and project it to a smaller Hilbert space. And that's kind of the trick. That's how we're gonna construct interesting states and interesting effective theories. Okay, so that's just the recipe for getting psi spin. So next, I want to tell you the recipe for getting the effective theory. And then after I tell you that general recipe, we'll do an example. Okay, so now we get to the harder part, constructing the low energy theory. Whoops. Construction of low energy theory. H effective. Okay. All right, so this H effective, as we'll see in a second, it's actually a gauge theory. It's gonna be a fermions coupled, it's gonna be something similar to that Hamiltonian H naught that we wrote down, but coupled to a gauge field. that's what the low energy theory looks like. So one of the key questions is, what is the gauge group? And so let me first tell you the recipe for kind of finding that gauge group. So what the first thing you need to do is kind of, in some sense, we're looking for all the symmetries in our system. In particular, in some sense, we're looking for all the local symmetries. But for the moment, I'm not going to phrase it that way. So we're going to find, first thing we want to do is we want to find, to find this gauge group, the recipe is you first want to find all on-site unitary symmetry transformations which I'll call U. And by on-site here, I mean they are just a product of unitaries acting on each fermion, each lattice site. Okay, so U is a product of, say, U sub I's, where each U sub I acts on a single site. So we want to find all on-site unitary symmetry transformations such that two things happen. So first, this should be a true symmetry of our mean field ansatz. So it leaves H naught invariant. Okay. So we're looking for things that leave our ansatz invariant, but that's not enough. If it just left our ansatz invariant, then this would be more like a traditional global symmetry. It wouldn't be a gauge symmetry. So there's an additional condition, which is that this U has to act trivially within our kind of physical spin Hilbert space. So U acts trivially within H spin. And what I mean by that is that it acts like just a pure phase. Okay, so if you restrict it to H spin, it's just a phase. Or if you want to write in terms of operators, another way to state the condition is that U commutes with all physical observables, so all physical spin observables. Okay, so the second condition is going to mean that this U operator isn't just a symmetry, it's kind of, it's almost a do-nothing transformation in terms of the physical variables. So it feels more like a gauge transformation. It doesn't change any physical quantity. Okay, so these are the two conditions, and we can find the set of all U's that have these properties, and those U's, well, there's a word for them, I think it's Shaogan came up with this name. Sometimes it's called the invariant gauge group. So the set of all U's form a group, and I'll call it the invariant gauge group, and I'm just going to denote it by G. And just, I'm going to need this notation in a second. To denote the different U's, these different symmetry transformations, I'm going to denote them with this notation, U upper subscript G. Okay, so for each group element, there's some corresponding unitary, which is we call U sub G. Okay, so now we get this gauge group, and in general, this gauge group could be, at least for the Slay Fermion construction, the kinds of groups that you get are things like U1, Z2, and SU2. Those are the three main possibilities. So I'm leaving it rather general here because this parton construction can be applied not beyond this sort of particular context, but in this context, generally G would be one of those three cases. You'll see that in examples, Z2, U1, or SU2. Okay, so now how do we get the low energy theory? So as I promised, this G, the symmetry transformations really correspond to something like a gauge symmetry. So to construct the low energy theory, basically what we're going to do, to construct the low energy theory, what we do is we just couple our mean field ansatz, our H naught, to a G gauge field. And actually, it's going to be important that this G gauge field is weakly fluctuating. So maybe I can say what that means a little bit later. But the low energy theory is a weakly fluctuating G gauge field. So maybe in an example, that'll be more clear what I mean by weakly fluctuating. Basically the gauge flux, weakly fluctuating here means the gauge flux is going to be weakly fluctuating. It's going to be, or another way to say it's a weak coupling. The gauge coupling constant is small. So the flux is almost not fluctuating very much. Okay, so this is the recipe. The recipe is once we find this invariant gauge group, we just couple H naught to a weakly fluctuating G gauge field. So now let me just tell you in a little more detail before we do an example. Let me just tell you in a little more detail how you go about constructing this this gauge theory. Okay, so the first thing you have to do when you couple something to a gauge field is you have to introduce the gauge field degrees of freedom. So step one is introduce gauge fields. And the gauge fields, since we're dealing with a lattice, they're going to live on the links. So introduce gauge fields on the links of our lattice. So now I need to draw a picture. So let me draw one here. So let me just draw. So here are our sites where our fermions live, slave fermions, where also our spins. And so now the fermions are hopping between these sites. So we're going to introduce, and let's just assume we're going to introduce gauge fields on the links. The links on which they hop. I'll assume it's just nearest neighbor hopping. We would introduce gauge fields on say these links. So each of these X's is going to denote a gauge field degree of freedom. I need to give it like a name to that. So what I'm going to call is, I'm going to label them as follows. So if I call this site I and I call this site J, I'm going to call this gauge degree of freedom GIJ. So IJ just tells you what link it lives on, and the little g tells you, so the gauge field lives in the gauge group. So that's the possible values it can take. So GIJ means on link IJ, that gauge field is in the G state. Okay, so let me switch back to black. Okay, so the gauge fields I'm gonna call GIJ. And as I said, these Gs, they run over group elements. So in the U1 case, it's going to run over phases. In the Z2 case, it could be sort of plus, it'll be two values, plus or minus. Or more generally, yeah. So that's the first thing. So now we're enlarging our Hilbert space even more. It seems like we're going the wrong direction, but this is the correct, this is the prescription for getting low energy theory. So we enlarge our Hilbert space even more. Now we have these gauge field degrees of freedom on the links. And then what? The next step is, maybe I can do it here. No space for it. I guess I can try and do it here. So step two is to write down the gauge theory Hamiltonian. So the gauge theory Hamiltonian is, in fact, this is our low energy theory. What does it look like? Well, you'll see this in an example, but the crude structure is it has two pieces. So the first piece I'll call H naught tilde, and the second piece I'll call H gauge. H naught tilde is basically you take your original mean field ansatz H naught and you minimally couple it to this gauge field. So this is H naught minimally coupled to this G gauge field that we just introduced. And what is H gauge? H gauge is just the Hamiltonian that describes the energetics of the gauge field. So there'll be some term which costs energy, that whenever you have gauge flux, there'll be some energetic penalty for that. And there'll also be a term that makes the gauge flux fluctuate which is an electric field energy term, or if you can think of it as electric field term. So this is the sort of the gauge Hamiltonian, gauge field terms. In the case of electromagnetism, it would be basically E squared plus B squared. Okay, so that's the step two. And it's a little matter when you see an example, see how to really write down this H naught tilde. So then the last step is the last step in writing down any gauge theory, maybe the most important step is that the Hilbert space for your gauge theory is constrained. You know, you don't work in the whole Hilbert space. You work within the so-called gauge invariant subspace. So the step three is we don't want to consider this Hamiltonian in this big, huge Hilbert space. We want to restrict it to gauge invariant subspace, the so-called gauge invariant subspace. And this is, for electromagnetism, that would be like imposing Gauss's law. We only restrict to states that obey Gauss's law, divergence of E equals rho. Now, in this particular case, there's a very specific prescription for how to define the gauge invariant subspace. So I want to tell you how that works. So specifically, we're going to restrict to states psi such that they obey the following kind of gauge invariance property. So let me just write it down and then I'll explain what these symbols mean. L, G, I, J. Okay, now let's try to explain what these symbols are in a second, but the basic structure, so let me, I'm gonna explain what all these things are, but the basic structure here, so I should draw a picture now, is this gauge invariant constraint holds for each, this is for each lattice site. Each lattice site I and each G in G. Okay, so here's our lattice site I. So for each lattice site I, we get a constraint. It's kind of like the Gauss's law constraint at that site. And what is the structure of that constraint? It's basically a constraint that relates these five degrees of freedom. The fermion degrees of freedom on that site and the gauge field degrees of freedom on the four neighboring sites. And so now let me explain exactly what the meaning of these symbols is. So what is LG? LG is left multiplication by G. So what it does, it acts, this IJ index tells you what link it acts on. So on a given link, if you had a state, say HIJ, and you, this is an operator. If you act on it by LG, it gives you GHIJ. Okay, so it shifts the gauge field. Okay, so this is a little bit like a gauge transformation. We are shifting the gauge field. So this product of Lijg is shifting the gauge field on these four links by G, right? Now, what about this other piece here? So that's the piece that acts on a given site. So let me explain what that is. That acts on the central site. So how are you? So Uig theta Ig are defined by, basically UIG is the symmetry operator acting on site I. So if you write UG, we said it was an on-site symmetry operator, so you can always write it as a product of UIGs. So UIG is just the operator acting on that site I. So what is theta? So I'll tell you what theta is in a second, but if you ignore theta for a second, then basically this thing here looks a little bit like a traditional gauge transformation, right? In each field on the four links out here, and then we're applying the symmetry operator or whatever on the central site. And then the last piece is this thing here. This is just a phase, this theta IG. So how's it defined? It's just the phase that's corresponding to UIG. Because remember, UIG acts trivially within H spin. was mentioned, but the symmetry operators act like a pure phase within H spin. So that phase is exactly was theta IG. Okay. So that's okay. So it's a little formal, but I wanted to give you the general prescription for how to write down the gauge invariant constraint for the slave fermion construction. Okay. And so so this is the general prescription. Now what I want to do next is work out an example, a particular example where we can really explicitly work out what the effective theory is. We'll see what this constraint looks like, and so on.
Michael, let me just interrupt a second and ask a question that's been trending in the Q&A, apparently.
Sure.
So I think the basic question is, do the gauge invariant degrees of freedom of H effective correspond to the original spin Hilbert space?
Very good question. So and perhaps what's being asked, let me see if I understand your question. Maybe you're asking, if I really restrict to this gauge invariant subspace, do I return to exactly my original spin Hilbert space? Is that maybe what's being asked?
Yeah, right.
So I would say the answer is no, it's not. If it were the same as the original Hilbert space, that would make the whole thing a lot easier to understand, but it's not the same as the original Hilbert space. It's still bigger than the original Hilbert space. So if you take, so the H spin, how should I say it? If you look at this constraint, no, it's a very good question. So if you look at this constraint here, all the H spin states obey, by construction, they obey this first piece here is equal to one acting on any physical state, right? So any physical state that lives within our spin Hilbert space, this acts on one, acts as one. So the spin Hilbert space actually corresponds to states which are not only gauge invariant, but also obey another property, which you could either say this is equal to one, or maybe another way to say it, I prefer this way, is that this is equal to one. So it, in some sense, the physical Hilbert space corresponds to both imposing this condition, but also imposing the condition that this is equal to one. Now the condition that this is equal to one, let's see, am I saying this right? So that's, that's the condition that in some sense, the divergence, well, you'll see it in an example. It's a stronger condition. It's kind of some condition about, you could say, the electric field on these links. Or maybe you could say that, yeah, maybe I should phrase it this way. It's the condition that you still have I should say it more simply this way. The spin Hilbert space always has exactly one fermion on each site, but the gauge invariant Hilbert space does not, right? You can have two fermions on this site or zero fermions on this site. Those are all allowed as long as basically the electric field it takes the right values that consistent with Gauss's law. That's basically what this thing says. So the short answer to your question is no, they're not the same. The gauge invariant Hilbert space is still larger than our original spin Hilbert space in some sense. It's not equal to our original spin Hilbert space. So the claim of the slave fermion construction is not that the whole Hilbert space matches. It's a low energy theory. So the claim is the low energy excitations of H effective within this Hilbert space will match the low energy excitations above our spin state. The whole Hilbert space definitely does not match. It doesn't even have the right dimension. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. Okay, so now, this is very formal. So let's do an example. I think this is gonna help. So the first example I want to do is something called the pi flux state. It's a particular ansatz, a particular mean field ansatz, a very simple one. So what is it? Well, as the name suggests, it's basically fermions hopping in a background gauge flux of pi. So I guess I'll write it this way. So H naught, it has no pairing term, just has hopping. Just has hopping, and what does this hopping look like? It's just nearest neighbor hopping. Let me write it out, the formula for it, and then I'll draw the picture. So it just has nearest neighbor hopping. So you can hop along an X link, or you can hop along a Y link, And the only thing that gives it any structure at all is that the hopping in the y direction can has a plus or minus sign depending on the x coordinate. Okay, so if I just drew it out, drew the picture of this, what it looks like, the hopping, just the sign of the hopping is always positive, let's say, or has the same sign on all the horizontal links, but on the vertical links, it alternates like that. Okay, so the if you look around a given plaquette, the product of these four is minus one. So there's a pi flux in each plaquette, hence the name pi flux state. Okay, so that's it. It's just hopping with this pi flux. Now we're gonna the ground state of this has has on average one fermion per site. Actually, if you as you probably know, if you look at the spectrum of this, it has Dirac nodes and so on. It's a Dirac-like spectrum. I think it has two Dirac nodes, if I remember correctly. And the ground state, because we set the chemical potential to be zero here, the ground state has exactly one fermion per site. Or at least that's right. So now that's a valid mean field ansatz. So now we want to construct the low energy theory. I'm not going to write down the spin state because, you know, although I could write it, you know, you could in principle compute it, it's not something you can write down analytically. You'd have to compute it sort of on a computer. But so instead of writing down the spin state, which you can do, let's construct the low energy theory. So the first thing we have to do is find the symmetry transformations that leave both our Hamiltonian invariant and our physical degrees of freedom invariant. So in this case, it's easy to see at least one symmetry transformation with this property, which is that you can multiply these fermion operators by a phase, right? So if you do that, clearly our Hamiltonian, since it's number conserving, the fermion number is conserved, this leaves H naught invariant, and it also leaves our spin operator invariant because, well, I mean, we can go back and look at it, but I don't know if we have to, but. Where is it? Yeah, because if I multiply this by a phase and this by the opposite phase, of course, the spin operator is left invariant. Okay, so this is an example of something that leaves both invariant. And in fact, these are the only transformations. So in this case, because it's parameterized by this phase chi, our invariant gauge group is U1. Okay, so our low energy theory is gonna be like these fermions coupled to a U1 gauge field. So let's just work out explicitly what it looks like. So let's introduce U1 gauge fields on the links. So again, I'll draw a picture. Okay, so we have our gauge fields are sitting here. And I'm gonna call, let's call this site I. I'll follow the same notation as before, except, you know, because this is like, I left out the most important link. Okay, so following sort of standard notation for U1 gauge theory, I'll call this gauge field degree of freedom e to the I aij. Okay, so the gauge fields on the links are e to the I aij. Okay, and now let's write down the low energy theory. And then we'll work out the constraint. Okay, so the low energy theory, the first piece is this H naught tilde piece where you take your original mean field Hamiltonian, mean field ansatz and just minimally couple it to this gauge field. So what that means is that hopping term, Tij term, when a fermion hops across a link, I should multiply that by the gauge field. So I get Tij e to the I Aij. Right. So that's the H tilde part. And then there's the H gauge part. And what is H gauge? So now let me write that down. So as I said, this is supposed to describe the dynamics of your gauge field. And for a union gauge field, at least there's a pretty sort of standard description. So there's the two terms. Let me just write it down. There's like an electric field term. This is like the E squared energy. And then there's like the B squared term, the energy for flux. And write that like this. It's a sum over Plaquettes, square Plaquettes, of sort of cosine. Since it's a U1 gauge field, the energy term has to be something that only depends on e to the IA. So it's actually cosine, usual way to write is cosine of this, cosine of this, the total flux. So I'll write that as APQ plus AQR plus ARS plus ASP. Okay. And just to be clear here about what these things mean, so A and E is the electric field, basically, and A is the vector potential, and they're canonically conjugate. So this is the vector potential. Whoops. And this is the electric field. So this first term here, this thing makes A fluctuate as promised, that makes the flux fluctuate, and this is the energetic cost for the flux. So now I said it was supposed to be weakly fluctuating, so now we can see in practice what that means. It means H should be small. So more precisely, we want H, that the low energy theory that the slave fermion construction gives you is the weakly fluctuating low energy theory. So H should be much smaller than K, and actually should also be smaller than T here. So we want to consider this. This is the low energy theory that comes out of the slave fermion construction. This is the weak, so this is from weakly fluctuating. So the claim then is that it's a kind of interesting claim. It says that there exists some spin state, which we didn't write down, whose low energy physics is described by this, this gauge theory. Fermions coupled to U1 gauge field in this weakly fluctuating limit. Okay, so now let's work out the gauge invariance constraint. Whoops. And hopefully this will also help clarify that question that was asked. You'll be able to see explicitly this gauge invariance constraint does not take you back to your original Hilbert space. It's still a bigger Hilbert space. Okay, so what is the gauge invariance constraint? So we have to just write down, follow that prescription. So first, let's write down the symmetry transformations. So the symmetry transformations U sub G, they're now parameterized by chi. Chi is the symmetry group element, lives in U1. If you just write out what this U sub chi is, so it multiplies F by this phase, e to the I chi. So if you just write that out, it's as an operator, you can write as e to the I chi times the total number. It's a phase rotation. So it's just e to the I chi times the total number of fermions. Okay, so that's the U1 element of invariant gauge group. Okay, so that's U chi. Now we have to work out what is UI chi. So UI chi is the part of this acting on a single site. So that's easy. That's just e to the I chi Fi alpha dagger Fi alpha, right? U chi is a product of UI chi over all I. And now we can work out also what is this theta I G or theta I chi. So to do that, we take UI chi and restrict it to the spin Hilbert space. And within the spin Hilbert space, of course, that there's a single occupancy. There's a single fermion on each site. So this thing here is always one. So ui chi is just e to the I chi. Okay, so we conclude then that e to the I theta I chi is just e to the I chi. So that's the, so I'm just trying to follow that prescription. So now we have everything we need to plug into our constraint, which actually I should give a name to. I'm gonna call this constraint, whoops. I'll call this thing star. So now I'm gonna plug into that. So I know what ui is, I know what e theta g is. And left multiplication is also simple. That's just something that's gonna shift the vector potential by chi in this case. So, okay, so if we substitute into star, maybe I should do that over here. What do we get? So let me write it out and then I'll explain where it comes from. So the left multiplication piece gives you this. This comes from the product of LG. Why is that? Because remember, E is canonically conjugate to A. So if I do E to the I chi times E, it shifts A by chi. So this does exactly our left multiplication transformation. And then the other piece, which is this, involves ui chi times E to the minus I theta I chi. You just combine these two, you combine these two pieces. That's the last piece. So then that gives me e to the I chi fi alpha dagger fi alpha minus one. And then the whole thing is supposed to be equal to one. Okay, so that's what you get from just following the prescription. And then, as I said, this comes from the left, the first part comes from left multiplication, the second part comes from the on-site symmetry transformation. Okay, and now now if we just look at this equation, we can basically take the log, if you like. We get an equation relating the electric field and the fermion number. So it takes a very familiar form. So let me write it down. Oh, I should say what these sites are. Sorry. Well, let me write it down and then I'll one. So sorry, so I didn't say what J, K, L, and M are. So maybe it was clear, but maybe I'll write it here. So these are that left multiplication runs over all the links which are which run into site I. So in this particular model, there are four links. So that's why I get this product over four. That's why I have four guys here. Okay, so this is the constraint that I get. And then if I look at that, I can notice that the thing on the left-hand side is actually like a lattice divergence. It's the sum of the electric fields coming out of site I. So if you just, we can use this lattice divergence notation. We can call this divergence of E at site I. That means the lattice divergence of E is equal to Fi alpha dagger Fi alpha minus one. So if you look at this equation here, this is the constraint. This is the usual, this is basically the usual Gauss's law, divergence of E equals rho, but there's this minus one here. So it's like we're working with a background charge of a unit background charge. There's like an extra offset here. So now you can also see that in answer to people's question about the structure of the Hilbert space, you can see that our Hilbert space does not enforce that this is equal to zero, right? That would be the physical, that the spin Hilbert space corresponds to the case where this is zero. But the gauge invariance constraint does not require this is equal to zero. It just requires that divergence of E is equal to that. So that's the final Hilbert. So that's the final structure of our theory. So to summarize, what do we have? We derived our low energy theory. It consists of a U1 gauge field, which I wrote down here, coupled to these fermionic particles, and with a more or less conventional gauge invariance constraint, but with a background charge. Okay, and so Michael, let me just.
You have about 10 minutes left.
I have how much?
About 10 minutes left.
Okay, so let me see what I just let me. What I was going to do next? Yeah, thanks. Let me see. I think I want to take some questions. So. All right, let me do one more thing maybe. I have to decide. I want to do one more thing, which is just We've gone to all this trouble to work out the low energy theory. So let me tell you about the physical properties, just quickly summarize the physical properties. So you can see that this slave particle construction, slave Fermi construction is giving us a pretty non-trivial low energy theory. So let me do that here. So what are the properties? It gives you some non-trivial states. Okay, so what are the properties of this high flux state? So first of all, I didn't write down the spin wave function for you, but you can, you know, even if you don't write it down analytically, you can still ask basic questions like, is it invariant under lattice symmetries, for example? And you can check that it's actually invariant under all lattice symmetries. So it's invariant under spin rotation. That part is easy to see because the original Hamiltonian is invariant under spin rotation, and the projection, the H0 is invariant under spin rotation, and the projection preserves that. But it's not just invariant under spin rotation, it's also invariant under lattice symmetries. That's maybe not as obvious because if you looked at the original ansatz, it looks like it breaks translational symmetry, but that's kind of an illusion because it still has a translational symmetry, a sort of modified translational symmetry. You could call it magnetic translation symmetry. The upshot is it's invariant under all the symmetries. So this is actually an example of a spin liquid, which is an interesting thing in and of itself. It's very hard to write down spin liquid states that don't break any symmetries, and we've managed to do it. But the other interesting thing, of course, is that the low energy theory. And what is the low energy theory? Well, so the low energy theory, well, we just saw what it was. It's this U1 gauge theory, and it's coupled to these fermions. And the fermions, I told you, they have a Dirac-like spectrum. They have two Dirac nodes. The low energy theory actually consists of them because they're two Dirac nodes and they're two spin flavors. I think, if I'm counting correctly. So there are four two-component Dirac fermions coupled to a U1 gauge field. So this is interesting. This is something, this theory of Dirac fermions, massless Dirac fermions coupled to a U1 gauge field, this is called compact QED3. It's like quantum electrodynamics in three space-time dimensions, well, with a certain number of fermions. So it's actually very, very interesting theory. It's behavior, low energy behavior, is actually not fully understood, but it could be an interesting conformal field theory, but possibly we don't actually know because it's a strongly coupled theory. But this is the prediction of the approach is that we have a physical, it predicts that there's a real spin liquid out there that has the OMBT theory where we have Hardin on one hand coupled to a U1 gauge field. Okay, so maybe this is a good time to stop for questions if there are any.
Okay, thanks, Michael, for the very clear talk. There are some technical questions in the Q&A that I think would be good to address now.
Okay.
So maybe let me find Nat and unmute him. Nat, if you can just go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, I was just wondering when you have this LG operator, mm-hmm. Do you need to have G inverse on certain legs so that they sort of cancel when you product over all sites so that you get the global
sum? Oh, yeah. So I was trying to be skip over a few details, but thank you. So the answer to your question is kind of comes over here. So I glossed over this. So here we have a group element on link IJ, but you might also want to define, there's some notation which is useful to define. So basically on each link, If there's actually two group elements you can associate it with, G and G inverse. So we use this notation where GIJ denotes the same state as G inverse JI. Okay, so that's just like saying if you have a gauge field G going from I to J, you see a gauge field J inverse, G inverse going from J to I. And so when you calculate this LG, I don't know if that answers your question about cancellation, but this is an important point that you have to direct, all the links have to be directed out from I. You have to direct them out from I. So if you look here, I had it, all the links started were IJ. I was the first index. And then you apply left multiplication. So if I don't know if that's what you're asking.
Yes, yes, thank you.
Yeah. Next, we have a question from Wanjun Choi. You can go ahead and unmute yourself.
Hello, I'm actually not so clear how this equation star you wrote.
Yeah.
Actually constrain the wave function into the gauge invariant subspace.
Ah, so let me see if I understand your question. So it's a constraint. This is, you see it's a constraint. I'm constraining psi to obey this particular equation. So maybe you're asking why should we interpret it as a gauge invariant constraint? Maybe, is that what you're asking? Okay, so that's in some sense just an interpretation, but the reason it's a gauge invariance constraint is because, this is kind of the, so I didn't review all of sort of the lattice gauge theory background, but I think a traditional, this is a gauge transformation, what I've written here, right? So if you look at how this acts on degrees of freedom, this actually acts like a traditional gauge transformation. So here, this thing, like let's think about the U1 case where this is Lij chi. This shifts the A field on the links ij by chi. That's what this does, okay? So this shifts the gauge field on all four of these links by chi. And then this piece here is performing a phase rotation on site I, also by the phase chi. So any fermion that's on that site gets multiplied by e to the I chi. So if you actually wrote out what this looks like, it's does something like aij, I might not get the signs right, but something like this. And then it takes fi to, I'm probably not getting the signs right, but up to signs, it's doing something like that. So this piece here, the left multiplication is shifting the gauge field. And then this piece here is if I ask how a fermion transforms under it, gets multiplied by e to the I chi. So this is sort of a traditional gauge transformation. And by requiring that psi is invariant under it, it's like requiring that we look at gauge invariant states. But this factor of e to the minus I theta, this is the slightly unusual part of this. That's like the background. There's a background charge. That's why the traditional gauge transformation, so if you look back at what we have here, traditional gauge transformation in lattice gauge theory would look like it's generated by this divergence of E minus F, right? So it doesn't have this minus one part. The traditional gauge transformation is generated by divergence of E minus F dagger F. This minus one part is coming from this E to the I theta G. I don't know if that answers your question, but
I think I get the point. Thank you.
Okay.
Let's take one more question from Dam Sun. Mm-hmm. I guess he could just ask you down the corridor. But...
Well, we're not. No, we're. I haven't seen him in 4 months.
Hi, Michael. I wonder if the procedure that you described is better to do in two steps. That is, first to write down a gauge theory on the lattice, but in the strong coupling limit, that is, in your language, H is equal to zero. Mm-hmm. And then mention that. So then I thought that this equation that you derived from the equation star would not have this this factor that related to the electric field because the charge is zero. So then you get. Then it seemed to me that you recover the original Hilbert space, and then imagine an RG procedure that would generate that kinetic term by integrate when you are integrate out the Dirac fermion's mode with a momentum larger than some cutoff. Is that a better, is that a correct way to think about this?
So let me see if I understand what you're saying. So I the first statement that you made, I think I understand and agree with, which is that if I look at the and I hopefully was going to maybe say something about this next time, I don't know. If we look at the limit, the strongly confining limit, the opposite limit where H is much larger than K, right? Then in that limit, we can sort of restrict ourselves to states where the electric field is zero on each link. And then if you look at, for example, this gauge invariance constraint, let's just say in this example, E is zero. So it indeed gives you, at least in that limit, the low energy states look, the lowest energy states look just like your original physical Hilbert space, right? Because if E is zero, then this gauge invariance constraint is actually forcing the Fermi occupation. Read that you take the strongly confined limit, so the limit where this H is very large, this procedure is somehow on a reasonable footing in the sense that the states that you get at the lowest energies of your gauge theory exactly look like your original Hilbert space. And then, if I understand you correctly, you want to argue that even if I'm in the different phase, the opposite limit, where K is much bigger, where H is small and K is much bigger than H, that it's still on a reasonable footing. And that part actually, I don't have a very sharp argument for that. So I agree that in the limit where H is very large, you do recover your original Hilbert space, and so everything seems safe. But the limit where H is small, I'm not sure exactly how to justify that this will work, except for maybe some kind of argument. Yeah, actually, that's something I want to understand better. How you can really bridge the from the confining phase to the other phase, the other limit, in a precise way. So if you know how to do that, maybe we can talk afterwards. I can present that tomorrow.
Thanks. I don't know how to do that.
Oh, well, you sounded like you had something. So maybe I'll...
No, it's just...
I'll ask you. I mean, there's something I'm struggling with is... Mm-hmm. My view of it, I don't know, it's still not well-formed, is that it's sort of an anomaly argument, which is that it's not that the Hilbert space match. You just want to make sure that the Hilbert space carries the same anomaly. And so as long as it has the correct anomaly in one limit, it has the correct anomaly in the other limit. And we know it has the correct anomaly in the confining limit by basically the argument you said. And so then it must be correct in the other limit as well. I don't know how to make that quite precise. So that's kind of the challenge. But I think that's the flavor of the argument that made sense to me.
Thanks.
So there are still some questions and hands raised, but I think we can just relegate them to the Q&A, which will happen in 10 minutes anyways. Let's just thank Michael and Shreyang, and we'll be back here very soon.